Today on the 21st, a conversation with Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. She's been mentioned as a possible running mate for presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. We'll also talk about Illinois state finances and the growing sense of quarantine fatigue.
My five-year-old just yesterday said, "Mommy, I miss my friends. Can I have a play date?" And I have to tell her, no, it's all about our health and safety.
Then, for many people, going for a run is a respite. But after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, black runners in Illinois are wondering if simply taking a jog could end their lives in racial violence. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As we go to air Wednesday morning, Illinois health officials are reporting more than 1,100 newly confirmed cases of COVID-19. And since March, officials say 4,923 people have died from the disease here. In America, the response to the global pandemic has been left largely up to individual state governments. In Illinois, as more and more people seem to be getting antsy about being ordered to stay home most of the time, the state is set to ease some restrictions later this week. Meanwhile, Illinois is struggling to find the money to pay for its ongoing operations. The budget the legislature adopted last weekend counts on a massive cash handout from the federal government. To find out about the prospects for that and more, I spoke yesterday afternoon with Democratic Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. Senator Duckworth, welcome to the 21st.
It's good to be on. Thank you.
So it seems like a lot of people in Illinois now are feeling like they are over the pandemic, right? Quarantine fatigue, I've heard it referred to as. And we see reports of Illinois license plates packing the parking lots of businesses in Missouri and Wisconsin and Indiana. Do you get that sense from people that they are just ready to move on with this? And if so, what should the government be doing to address that?
Well, I sympathize with folks feeling very claustrophobic and that they are ready to be over with this. But my first message is we must stay safe. I mean, I have in my household a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old, and my 79-year-old mom. You know, they're over it as well. My 2 and 5-year-old, my 5-year-old just yesterday said, "Mommy, I miss my friends. Can I have a play date?" And I had to tell her no. But it's all about our health and safety. And we don't want to have a rebound and be forced to, instead of having an orderly emergence from our shelter in place, to rush so far in front of the testing and the capability to handle this pandemic and be forced to go back to the very restrictive shelter in place. So what I say to folks is please, be patient. And the best way that we're going to be able to emerge out of this in an orderly manner is exactly the way the governor has been talking about it, right? And this phase plan. And because we don't want to have to go backwards, that's going to be even more painful for the economy and for everyone.
And so you support the phase plan, it sounds like, because I've heard public health experts who say, you know, maybe we need to figure out a way to, instead of asking people sort of like abstinence only education in the realm of, you know, what we teach students about, you know, safe sex and things like that. Maybe we need something like that for COVID, which is like, well, here's how you can live with it, as opposed to you just have to stay home and stay away from people and that sort of thing.
Well, that's what the phase plan is, though, right? The phase plan is a way for us to slowly move forward in a way to cope with the COVID pandemic. And it's also tied to the ability for us to ramp up testing. One of the things we've been able to do, one of those benchmarks is 10,000 tests per day. We're now upwards of 18,000 per day. That's critical. We can't open the economy the way we want to unless we have widespread, low-cost testing. And so I do think that the phase plan is a way for us to move forward in a way that our healthcare system can keep up with providing the testing and also the treatment for folks who will come down with this illness. So I would have to say that, I don't think comparing the phase opening gradual opening to complete abstinence is an accurate comparison. I think it's actually the very responsible way to move forward so that we can start to do things, but just in a way that our healthcare system can manage to keep up with it. Because we certainly, I don't know anyone who wants our hospitals to be completely overrun and in crisis mode again. I certainly don't.
And so as I know a few of you, I know you and a few of your colleagues have written to the Trump administration as we're looking ahead to what is next for COVID-19 and the pandemic, talking about preparedness for flu season and a possible resurgence of coronavirus disease later this year. I wonder, taking a sort of broader look, what should America be doing to prepare for the next pandemic? And has that shifted your priorities as a legislator?
Well, I don't think my priorities have shifted. And I do think that my priorities are consistent with what I think America should be doing. I think it's several things. Number one, we need widespread and low-cost testing. Anyone and everyone who needs a test should be able to access it. Until that happens, we are in a dangerous situation. And I don't mean just, you know, celebrities in Hollywood who can seem to get a test whenever they want. I want the person who works at McDonald's who's keeping my daughter supplied in chicken McNuggets because there are days when she won't eat anything else. I want those workers to be able to afford and have access to a test. I want the janitors who are cleaning our hospitals. I want the person who works at, you know, the Dominick's and the local grocery store who is checking out everyone. The people who are on the front lines of this pandemic, even though they never signed up to be on the front lines of a global pandemic, I want those folks to be able to be tested and be able to afford the testing. Because if they can't afford, if the test is even $50, people who are working for minimum wage cannot afford to pay that. And so they will come to work even though they think they might be ill. And that only makes the situation worse. So number one for me is widespread, low cost, if not free testing. The second thing is making sure that our hospitals and our frontline healthcare workers have the resources that they need. That is the funding from the federal government to keep our hospitals operating. And then also all of the PPE and supplies that they need to continue to move forward and treat their patients. And that gets to the third thing, which is something I've been pushing this administration so hard on, the Trump administration, which is the logistical network. We have to be able to provide the PPE, resupply our national stockpiles, and provide ongoing access to all the protective equipment. I've been talking to hospitals all up and down the state, you know, from the north side of the loop all the way down to far southern Illinois. And they all say the same thing. They are still having problems accessing adequate PPE beyond a 2-week or 3-week period. And we can't get in front of this pandemic if our hospitals and our frontline workers can't be protected from it. And so for me, those are my three main priorities. And of course, contact tracing that goes with the access to testing as well. Mm-hmm. I think those are critical for us to be able to reopen and deal with this pandemic well into the future. I don't see how we move forward without those three things.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. Senator, last weekend, as you know, the Illinois General Assembly passed a state budget that relies on billions of dollars in federal aid that your colleagues in the U.S. House have approved, in some form at least. Will the Senate come through to pass an aid package to help the ailing state and local governments across Illinois?
Well, if Dick Durbin and I have any say in it, yes. We're going to push hard for additional aid to come out to state and local governments. In the CARES package that we passed over a month ago, there was $150 billion that was supposed to go across the country. The first $50 billion of that was supposed to go to each of the 50 states. And then the remaining $100 billion was supposed to be divided among the states and municipalities based on population. That money has not all gone out yet. So we're pushing the Trump administration very hard to get the rest of that money out while we negotiate the next CARES package, which we'll be doing in the Senate next week to make sure that we get more funding to go out to states and local governments. And this is something that's very bipartisan, because local governments are the ones that are on the front lines of this crisis. They're the ones that are seeing the revenue shortfalls. They're the ones that are having to pay extra money to buy higher cost PPE for their paramedics and their firefighters and their police forces. And this is, you know, this happens in red states and blue states. This happens across America. So I think we can find bipartisan support for getting more funding out to state and local governments. The question is, how do we put together a package that everyone can vote on? And for me, again, the priority is going to be for our healthcare facilities, especially in rural communities where these healthcare facilities are often the largest employer in a tri-county area, and also probably the only critical care providers in a tri-county area in many cases. And then, of course, making sure that we get money into the municipalities themselves, not just to get state governments, but into local municipalities as well.
Well, you mentioned if it was up to you and Senator Durbin, but of course, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is going to have something to say about this, and he has not been super enthusiastic, to say the least. Do you have a sense that, is he going to come around on that, do you think?
I think he's going to be forced to come around, because I think my colleagues on the Republican side of the aisles know that their states are hurting as well. And that municipalities all across this country are hurting. This is an American issue. This is not a red or a blue state issue. This is something where municipalities in Republican areas are hurting just as much as those in Democratic areas. And even Illinois, you know, where people think of Illinois as just a blue state, but we have people who are hurting all across this the state. And in fact, in many of our rural communities are hurting even more than large metropolitan areas. So I think Mitch McConnell will be forced to come to the negotiating table, not just by Democrats, but by his own Republican members as well.
And before I move off this budgetary topic, the last thing I want to ask about is, as you know, Illinois Senate President Dunn. And here we are in the era of COVID-19, where we're all interviewing from home. I don't know if you need to take a moment to...
Nope, I'm fine. I'm sorry. That's my 2-year-old.
Nope, it happens.
She just woke up from her nap. I apologize.
No, that's okay. Like I said, I've got the door shut and hope that my own kids don't come bursting in at any moment.
Yeah. So
as I was saying, Illinois Senate President Don Harmon has asked for specifically for federal money to help the Illinois state pension funds. And I wonder, is that something that's possible, or is that a non-starter in your view?
You know, I am not looking at that. I think that my priorities for dollars is going to be, again, healthcare facilities, and then directly into the states with flexibility on how they are able to make up lost revenue in the states. But the pension funds, are not my priority in terms of, writing into the next aid package that, specifically that will go to pension funds. I think that what we need to do is help states be able to recover from lost revenue, and then also for the additional costs that they are having to, take on as a result of the pandemic.
You have been widely reported to be on former Vice President Joe Biden's shortlist for his own vice presidential pick for this election. Can you talk about that process? Where are you on that? Is that something you are open to?
Well, that process just moves on its own. I'm not getting involved in that process. My focus is on getting Joe Biden elected. I do apologize for my 2-year-old. In fact, I'm like all the other working moms out there, right? We're trying to hold it all together and do our jobs and also take care of our babies. So this is my my shout out to all of the working families out there who are doing the same thing that I'm doing. But listen,
totally. I feel bad for keeping you from her.
No, so. It's fine. She's just putting on a hardcore press because she knows, the mommy guilt will kick in. No, listen, I am focused on getting real leadership into the White House so that we can, as a nation, emerge out of this global pandemic and rebuild our economy. Our nation is facing a crisis right now that it has not faced in terms of severity, this level of severity in quite a while. And I believe that Joe Biden is the right person with the right experience to address many of the issues that President Trump has failed to do. I mean, he's really miserably failed at responding to this crisis. And even moving forward in terms of, something as simple as refilling the national stockpiles on protective equipment. So I will let that process move forward. Obviously, it is an honor to have my name mentioned in the same breath as a Tammy Baldwin or any of the other wonderful women whose names have been mentioned, but I am really just focused on getting Joe Biden elected. I'll let that other process move along on its own without my interference. I got enough on my plate, as you can hear.
Sure. And on a serious point on this, though, there has been a lot of attention to allegations by a woman named Tara Reid against the former vice president, actually when he was a U.S. senator. I wonder, where are you on that? Do you believe Tara Reid's allegations against the former vice president?
Well, let me just say first that any victim of abuse should be listened to and deserves to be listened to. And I think that one of the things that Joe Biden has done clearly is he's addressed this head on, and he's allowed, you know, he has called for his records to be released by the Senate, his personal records. And I think he has very credibly addressed these issues. And he has actually stepped out of the way of any investigations that any of the major journalists have been conducting, which I think is the right thing to do. I think this contrasts very sharply with President Trump, who is known to have tried to silence his accusers, someone who has actually gotten major tabloids to buy the stories of his accusers and actually kill them, someone who has threatened and harassed all of the accusers, and who is actually on record boasting about sexually assaulting women. So there's a big difference here. And I think that Tara Reid should be listened to. She has been listened to. I think Joe Biden has addressed the issue in a very credible manner. And I think that, as he said, you know, let the Senate release his personnel records and let's let that move forward. But let's not equate what's happening here to the very real problems that, you know, and the very real issues that President Trump has demonstrated throughout his years. And in fact, he himself has boasted about sexually assaulting women, recorded, you know, having conversations about this. There's a very big difference between these two situations. So let's not sort of equate the two.
Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth, we thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Coming up after the break, going for a run is supposed to be energizing, but after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, runners who are Black are wondering if something as innocent as simply taking a jog could end their lives in racial violence. That conversation after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've spoken on the show before about jogging during the pandemic, how it can be a form of stress relief. And since it can be done alone and outside, it falls under the category of safe activities under current social distancing requirements. But for people of color, going outside for a jog or any number of activities can sometimes mean what one writer has called an exhaustive mental checklist to avoid a racist encounter or even racist violence. Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old Black man, was out exercising in Brunswick, Georgia, when he was followed by two white men in a truck with a shotgun, who said he resembled someone wanted for robbery. The two men in the truck, a father who was a former police officer and his son, fatally shot Arbery. Arbery's family attorney says the Justice Department is now investigating the shooting death as a hate crime. Meanwhile, in Minneapolis, four police officers have been fired after one of them held his knee on the neck of a Black man named George Floyd, who was pronounced dead at a hospital. And over the weekend, another video emerged out of New York City where a white woman named Amy Cooper called the police on a Black man who was out bird watching. He had just asked her to follow park rules and put a leash on her dog. She since apologized and lost her job, but it's sadly the latest example of a person of color going about a seemingly banal activity like birding or jogging that turns into something that is at best unpleasant and at worst potentially deadly because of the problem of racism in America. To talk more about this, we're joined now by Kurt Streeter. He covers sports for the New York Times and is based in Seattle. He published an article last week called Running While Black. He also writes about race, gender, and social justice. Kurt, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate I'd also like to welcome Eric McDuffie. He's been an avid runner since 2007, everything from one-mile races to marathons. He's also an associate professor of African-American studies and history at the University of Illinois in Urbana. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. And joining us on the line from Detroit is Maria Stanfield. She's a psychologist. She's also an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit, an organization that encourages African-American women to get into jogging. Maria, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And if you out there would like to join the conversation, you can always tweet us at 21st Show, that's 21st Show, or join the conversation by giving us a call, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Kurt, I want to begin with you. You write about this, quote, exhaustive mental checklist that you go through when you're headed out for a run, on a run. Can you tell us some of the things that go through your mind when you're preparing to go out?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the first things that that goes through my mind is the fear of something happening, like somebody thinking I'm a prowler or I shouldn't be in their neighborhood, calling the police, and then somehow the police, coming up on me and then things going awry from there, as we've seen happen so many times. That's really always been, where I run at least, my biggest fear. I don't necessarily fear, and I don't really go through the checklist of people coming upon me in a truck with shotguns. Yeah. Although I do know that something like that could happen. But really, you know, it's people who fear Black males, Black people in the neighborhood that I live in Seattle, Washington. It's first of all, Seattle's one of the whitest cities in America, and I live in predominantly white neighborhood where a lot of really great folks, but they're not really used to seeing Black faces around. So when I'm jogging down the street, and if I've got a hoodie or if I'm dressed in a certain way, I think about all this sort of thing, how I'm seen, am I going to be seen as a threat? What's going to happen then based on that? So you think about your clothing, you think about things like, slowing down to, let's say, look at homes that are really interesting to me, or somebody's garden, right? I love stuff like that. But I don't tend to stop and look and take in the what's around me, because I don't want to be seen. There's something in the back of my mind about, the fear of being seen as somebody that's looking for an open door or an open window. And I know that's absolutely just crazy to be thinking of, but or to be worried about while I'm out running, supposedly enjoying my time, supposedly relaxing and kind of in my own meditative state, which is really why I run. I think why so many of us run. But the fact that there's just this constant background noise, and sometimes it's small, sometimes it's often just a small kind of voice in the back of your head. And sometimes, as it was after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, it was really, really, really tough to run in those first few days after that, after looking at that video.
Yeah. And it's obviously not something that a white person from the neighborhood would have to think twice about, I'm sure.
Not at all. Especially not where I live. Where I live. I mean, I'm probably literally, I don't think that there's a Black male adult who lives probably within 5 or 6 blocks of me. There's very few just in this overall neighborhood. That's not uncommon in Seattle.
Yeah.
So
I wonder,
it's a little different maybe than in parts of Illinois and much of the country. Seattle's a very, very homogenous type of place, especially when it comes to the Black population, very, very small Black population here.
Yeah. Is this something, this mental checklist and these sort of thoughts you're talking about, has this been going on since you've been running? I mean, did it start at some point? Maybe you can talk a little bit how you got into the sport of running.
Yeah, it's not new at all. You know, I started running. I've always been an athlete. I didn't really enjoy running until I got into it in about 2005 when my dad was dying and he was in the hospice, and I would take time then to go start going on runs just because I needed to process and I needed to meditate on what was happening, figure out how to help him and that pain. And I found it to be, you know, that to be incredibly important to that time in my life. But even then, you know, I'm definitely not, you know, noticing looks that I get, sort of objectifying looks sometimes when you're out there. Sometimes they're not always negative. I mean, they're often not negative looks, but it's a look of kind of surprise. What's that person doing here? You're being objectified and being made an object instead of a human being. It can be a form of aggression in its own right, even when people are smiling at you. You know, it's maybe akin to what some, you know, women, I always think of how women often feel when men gawk at them. And that can be a part of it. But that's when I started running when my dad was dying. And, you know, I got to say, you know, you're in Illinois. One of the things that's always gone through my mind that I've always remembered is the killing of Ricky Birdsong, the basketball coach at Northwestern, who was killed in front of his children while he was out on a run, as far as I understand, in a Chicago suburb. And he was killed by a white supremacist who came into their neighborhood. You know, since I'm in the news and a reporter, I've always been very aware of that. And I mean, in 2005, when I started running, it was maybe 5 or 6 years after the Birdsong killing happened. But that as I was running, I was thinking of Ricky Birdsong, and I frequently think of that killing. You know, you can just run into a neighborhood, and you could, by chance, just come upon somebody that has less than your best interests in mind, and might want to do something like that. Just the fact that happened, that was always on my mind. You know,
yeah.
And I've run all over the world too. You know,
sure,
My job, I go to Melbourne, or I go to London, I go to where you know, wherever sports might take us. And I mean, I feel like, you know, Black people are targets and objectified and worried about really all over the world. And even I have to say in our own neighborhoods, you know, often that's something that's really not talked about that much, but
yeah,
the way that sometimes, you know, in our own neighborhoods, we have to watch our back. It's just, it's a sad state of affairs, which I really pin on, you know, white supremacy, and that idea, I think, has permeated the entire world, and even within our own community to some degree, maybe subconsciously, a sort of fear of ourselves at times. So it's complicated, and race is a tough, tough, nettlesome, complicated subject.
It is. And if you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We've been speaking with Kurt Streeter, who covers sports for the New York Times. We're also joined by Eric McDuffie, who's a runner in Urbana and a professor of African American Studies at the University of Illinois, and Maria Stanfield, who's an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. Professor McDuffie, I want to turn to you. You run in Urbana, and you're actually, I understand, planning on doing a special running challenge where you run every 5 miles every 4 hours, if I have that right, over the course of a day. And, you know, it being a 24-hour period, some of that is going to be at night. I wonder what's going through your head as you're planning this.
Sure. Well, thanks. Well, first, if I can just begin right quick, I would like to express my solidarity for Brother Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, but also Breonna Taylor, Corrine Gaines, black women who also have lost their lives to state violence, to white terrorism. I think too often when we talk about violence against Black people, we too often focus only on men. And we have to keep in mind that women and girls to experience this kind of violence. But to answer your question, yes, so I am planning this Friday to run. It's part of a challenge. I'm part of a running crew here in Urbana, and some of my colleagues, my friends, have been running 30 miles in 24 hours. And which means that if I'm going to do that, I have to basically, I plan to run every, as you pointed out, every 4 hours or so, which means I have to run at night, probably at 10 p.m. and 2 a.m. And my parents, actually, who live in the Cleveland area, might be listening to this program. And I wasn't going to tell them about this until after I did it, in case anything happened. But, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, should I call the cops and inform them before I go out and run that there'll be an African-American man running through Urbana at, you know, 10 p.m. or 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And I should also note that I was thinking about running with my partner, who is a woman, and given her concern about her safety, you know, it would make sense for her to run with me. But I should also note that she's white. So I'm thinking, right, just where I'm going here, right? So
yeah.
If I'm out at 2 a.m. and I'm running through the dark streets of Urbana and somebody sees a black man running down the street with a white woman, who knows what kind of phone call could be made. So I've been thinking about that quite a bit, about what I'll do, if I'll call the cops or not. But I have thought really carefully about the route that I'm going to take. I'm not going to run down any streets that don't have streetlights. So I've been thinking a whole lot about this. But in my years of running, you know, I've been called the N-word, I've been heckled, you know, just all the nines, you know, I've seen, experienced.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. We're also joined in our conversation now by Maria Stanfield. She's with us. She's an ambassador for Black Girls Run in Detroit. And Maria, as a runner yourself, are there things that you do to prepare and protect yourself as you go out jogging? What's going through your mind?
Absolutely. And those things continue to grow as we are placed at risk for physical violence, as well as being placed at risk to be hit by a vehicle. Many runners, male and female, begin their runs at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., because they want to run like it's we're in the heat of summer, right? So they want to run at the coolest time of the day. So they oftentimes run very early in the morning. And what that means is, as a Black woman, and any runner would do this, but in me in particular, being a dark-skinned African-American woman, I make sure that I have on my lighted vest. I oftentimes will wear my lamp, my headgear, and sometimes I'll put on some additional lights on my body just so that I know that people see me. But even though I know they see me, it is also the when they see us. And what I mean by that is sometimes I know a driver may see me, but they'll still become, and the road is very wide, but they'll still come very, very close. And what some of my co-runners on the call have been speaking to in terms of going to communities that there may not be a lot of African-Americans in the community. We don't necessarily know that going into the community, but we do go into communities that are very nice, often in parks, often very, very nice architecture or murals, because running is an experience and you want to experience the fullness of the environment when you go. So you pick routes that are different. And sometimes when people who are not of color see African Americans, I have been heckled many times. I've almost been hit by a car 3 times, and one time was very bad. I ended up injuring my knee, but there's not just the mental, but the physical and things that you have to put in place to make sure that you're safe when you're out on a run. And then, of course, we know that we are, whether we're running or not, we have the implicit bias. People make assumptions about us as if our color in itself is a weapon that they have to protect themselves from. And some of the some of my co-runners on the line have spoken to that, just about the disparities and the actual acts of violence that African-Americans, both male and female, have come in contact with just because of that implicit bias.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to have to take a short break here, but I want to continue this conversation. Please stay on the line with us. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. We've been speaking with members of the running community about their reactions to the killing of Ahmaud Arbery and their experiences and the exhaustive mental checklists that they sometimes go through to ensure their safety for fear of racist violence and discrimination. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We've been speaking with members of the running community about their reactions to the killing of Ahmaud Arbery and also about their experiences and the exhaustive mental checklists that they sometimes have to go through to ensure their safety for fear of discrimination. We've been talking with Kurt Streeter, who covers sports for the New York Times, Eric McDuffie, a runner in Urbana, who's also a professor of African-American studies at the University of Illinois, and Maria Stanfield, who's an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. And I want to bring another voice into the conversation now. Helen Neville is a professor of educational psychology and African-American studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She researches racism, racial identity, and diversity issues related to well-being. She's also the current president-elect of the Society for the Psychological Study of Culture, Ethnicity, and Race, which is a division of the American Psychological Association. Professor Neville, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me to talk about this incredibly important topic.
Yeah, so as we've been talking about, there's this idea out there that running or taking a walk outside is a healthy and relaxing activity, and it's supposed to be one of the few safe things people can do at this time of pandemic. But obviously people of color have what Kurt referred to in his article as this exhaustive mental checklist before going out. And this is not just about running. This is something that some people say they feel every time they leave the house, they have to think about these things. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what kind of effect that can have on a person.
Sure. I think a lot of what you're talking about is what psychologists, in particular Robert Carter and other psychologists, talk about as racial trauma. And this is really this emotional and physical responses to encounters with white racial violence or anti-Black racism is what we're talking about now. So this idea about this exhaustive mental checklist is really this response to racial trauma. And these racial trauma can be linked to people's individual experiences. So you had the three runners talk about their own individual experiences. But it also can be, this trauma can come from, it could be vicarious. So like for all of us who have to see on the news every night, the killing of Black men and Black women, that can be traumatic as well, because these folks represent our communities and what happened to them is so atrocious. And so dealing with this racial kind of trauma, these emotional consequences to these disturbing events. And so what is that like mental, that exhaustive mental checklist? What does that look like? What kind of impact does it have? How does it show up in our everyday lives? It can show up like feeling tense or anxious, tearing up frequently, lacking concentration, having a hard time relaxing, having anger outbursts, having a hard time concentrating, can't stop thinking about the events, having trouble sleeping, having problems with our digestive system, feeling it in our bodies. So while we experience these traumas, we can't just leave them and in this little silo. They stay with us often, I think that's important. There's a scholar, William Smith at Utah University, that talks about this idea about racial battle fatigue. So it's this, when they talk about exhaustive mental checklists, this is really a reflection of this racial battle fatigue, where people are exposed to these chronic kind of racial stressors, anti-Blackness, racial violence, where it builds up resentment, maybe even people withdrawing from a social situation, feeling just worn out from all the day-to-day racism. And so that's the way that it shows up in us. What hasn't been talked about in terms of just this, the impact that it has, is what impact does this have on our children, particularly African-American children who hear about this, who see this? Obviously, we tried to shelter folks, or we tried to kind of, explain it. But experiences with white racism and racial violence is terrifying for youth. I'll give you just one example. I took our granddaughter, who lives with us, was 12 at the time. We went hiking in a beautiful little area that's about 30 minutes away from Champaign-Urbana. And I decided to treat her and one of her friends to lunch. And we stop off at this little diner. It was really cute. But my granddaughter was raised in Georgia, much like the place where, when we're talking about Ahmed Arbery. And she's like, I don't feel safe in this little town. I don't want to go into the restaurant. So I convinced her to go in. And for the entire time that she's eating, she's telling me how scared she is, how she doesn't know what's going to happen, how they don't stop off in towns like this in Georgia. And she was so worked up that after we ate and were leaving, she was vomiting. So this idea of what we're experiencing, it's impacting our youth too, because they don't have some of the coping mechanisms that we have built up over time.
Wow, that is such a powerful story. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. And it reminds me that, Kurt, in your piece for the New York Times, you write that you've been running with your son. Do you talk about these dangers with him? Can you talk about that experience?
I'm very careful with that. And just as the professor was noting, I mean, I'm very aware of that and worried about the trauma and how he perceives these risks and him taking on these fears, how he will handle that. He's 9 years old. And we really, during the pandemic, we started running as our way to like kind of end days, or about 5 o'clock after his, all of his school Zoom calls and all that. And so it's been a great way for us to bond. A lot of times, as he's grown up, we've talked a lot about race. He's in an unusual situation because, he's not raised around a lot of Black folks other than his family. And he's also extremely light skin tone. So he may end up experiencing the world quite a bit differently than I do. But as we, so it's all, in other words, it's always on our plate. It's always something that we talked about, but we talk about it very cautiously and carefully. Regarding the killings, and I basically have avoided exactly telling him what's happened, the worst that can happen, because I don't want to freak him out about running. There's a neighborhood near us that's really white and really exclusive, and I don't really feel comfortable there. I've just told him, Dad doesn't want to go jog there, for now. I've sort of had it with that place, as nice as it is, but it's his favorite route. So it's a little bit hard. He doesn't quite get that. And I've told him, not a lot of people like us there, and I don't feel that comfortable with us being there. And I've sort of left it at that. So yeah. It's a tough thing. It's a really tricky thing. That trauma that the professor talked about is very, very real. Definitely.
If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. That's Kurt Streeter. He covers sports at the New York Times. We're also speaking with Professor Helen Neville. She's a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois. Professor Eric McDuffie, who's a runner in Urbana and also a professor of African American studies at the University of Illinois. And Maria Stanfield, an ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. And Maria, I wonder if you can talk about that idea of children and, getting children involved in the activity of running. I mean, it's a big thing. We're told to promote healthy youth, but I mean, are you, do you have concerns about that? Do you share the Or do you see the sense of fear among younger people that we've been talking about?
Well, I am a mother. My children are adults now. My son is 21 and my daughter is 25. But my son wrestled for Michigan State University and has been an all-state athlete. And my daughter played basketball for many years. And wrestling is a sport that takes you traveling all around the country as well. So I have seen, and he plays football, I have seen my children be privy to racism around the globe on numerous occasions. Now, when it comes to running, I have volunteered with a local organization called Girls on the Run. And when you talk about running in with children, and it's more like a controlled environment. Oftentimes there's a track involved. It's not as broad unless you're running with a team, and there are several youth running teams, but it's not as broad as some of the exposure that we as adults are privy to. And I think that it's up to us also to guard our children and have responsible conversations about some of the trauma and the atrocities that are taking place as it pertains to African-American men and women, because we don't want to increase their anxieties or their exposure to adverse experiences. They're going to experience some of those experiences no matter what, because of the media, they see them. So if you see them, you can't hold your head in the sand. But we do have a responsibility as adults and parents to protect them as much as we can as well. That doesn't mean that we don't let them know the dangers that society face, but it does mean that we don't further traumatize them by exposing them.
And Eric, I wonder where... Yeah. Yeah. Eric, I wonder where you are on this question. I understand you have some young children yourself.
Yes. I mean, this is a very, very tough question. You know, how do you balance sharing or having very tough conversations about racial violence while at the same time not trying to traumatize your children? So my daughter's 16. She has started to run by herself. And of course, I'm concerned about her and her well-being out there. And my son is going on 12. Even just before all the stuff that's happened, you know, I and their mother always talked with them about possibilities of being attacked, the importance of being aware of their surroundings. But I've also talked with my neighbors, most of whom are white. And I've asked them if they could be safe houses. So in the event that my kids are walking or running through the neighborhood and they feel unsafe, if they feel like they're being chased, they're being stalked, that they can go to these homes and be safe in the event that they feel like their life is at risk or if they feel like they are threatened. But this is something that I think about all the time. And just the fact that I go out and that I will go out this weekend, and I think my daughter might actually be listening to this as we speak. You know, certainly I'm going to have a conversation with them about this.
And I'm afraid we only have about a minute and a half left in our conversation. And Professor Neville, I want to end with you. And I know this is a big question, but I wonder what, you know, we've seen these acts of solidarity after the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. People around the country, you know, running 2.23 miles, wearing a white T-shirt. But, you know, beyond social media posts and simple acts like that, what are some of the biggest things that people, and especially white people, can do on an individual level or an institutional level to stop incidents like the one we saw in Central Park or the killing of Ahmaud Arbery?
Great. Thanks for that. I'll try to wrap this up, but I do have one quick point that as a follow-up to our previous discussion.
Sure.
When you do talk about these racial incidents with children, it's also important to talk about racial cultural advancement and accomplishments and contributions so that kids just don't get an image that Black folks are people that are oppressed and and are survivors of racial violence, but they also have contributed intellectually, culturally to society.
That's a great point.
We have to give messages of cultural pride. In terms of,
and I'm afraid we just have about 30 seconds. So,
okay, what can folks do? One is educate themselves and continue to educate themselves about what's going on to begin to explore the root causes of these. These aren't just isolated incidences, that they are linked to a systematic form of racism, structural racism, and white supremacy. So educate and don't stray away from that. Read, learn, and then once they are educated, to take action to identify those organizations that are doing some really good work in this area. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, they can either contribute money or just show up in other ways. So
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Helen Neville is a professor of educational psychology and African American studies at the University of Illinois. We've also been speaking with Kurt Streeter of the New York Times and Eric McDuffie, a professor of African American studies at the University of Illinois, and Maria Stanfield, ambassador for Black Girls Run Detroit. Thank you all so much for being here. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.